Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
And thanks very much for listening. On the program this week, we will take another look at the acquisition reforms Congress is setting itself up to tackle next year. As we've talked about before on this program, members of the committees who handle these kinds of topics are doing a lot of asking around about what the next round of reform should look like. So we'll talk to one of the leaders of those groups later on in the hour about how DOD might be able to fix IT acquisition in particular. First, though, let's talk a bit about data center consolidation. It's been a hot phrase in the federal IT community for the last few years, but the Defense Information Systems Agency has been working on it for quite a while. By DISA's reckoning, it had more than 150 brick-and-mortar facilities in the 1990s. By the end of the 2000s, it was down to 18 huge centers, Defense Enterprise Computing Centers, as they're now called, or DECs. And to take things one step further, DISA's been consolidating those DECs since 2008. It had 18 then, and it has 10 now. The latest to close was in Huntsville, Alabama. That happened at the end of May, and DISA says that closure alone is saving the government just over $3 million a year. We'll talk with two of DISA's senior officials during this part of the show. Alfred Rivera is the Vice Director for Strategic Planning. He was the agency's point man for data centers for the past couple years before that job. David Bennett is our other guest for the first half of the show. He is DISA's Chief Information Officer. The first voice you'll hear in this interview, though, is Alfred Rivera. I asked him for a quick overview of the process DISA uses when it's deciding which data center should stay and which one should be shut down.
I think there's two factors that we looked at when we started consolidating. One was, in fact, you know, a lot of that was based on capitalization. So we capitalized a lot of legacy workload, a lot of workload that was not necessarily, using current technologies. And as we started, when we capitalized it and started moving it toward more of a standard architecture using some of our agile contracts and like capacity services, we were able to reduce a lot of the need to carry that much floor space and footprint. And so looking at that, and then looking at the how we can best align certain capabilities, like, for example, moving common functionality together in a common data center like logistics, as well as some of our mission partners, like moving Air Force to a finite set of data centers, we recognize that we could start reducing some of the data centers across the continental United States. And that's why we started in earnest, not only just, you know, closing data centers, but actually changing the way we ran business. For example, we picked or focused on certain data centers to run specific mission partners. And that allowed us to look across the enterprise and see what we can reduce. Second piece of that was also the investment would be required to get them up to the standards that we wanted to meet to have high availability, high resiliency in those data centers. Some of those would have just been cost prohibitive to do that with the budget that we had starting back in 2008. And so we recognized that and said these data centers will not probably be able to be, we cannot put the investment in there, and therefore we started shutting those. And that got us to the 11 and 10 data centers that we're at right now.
I'm speculating here, but I'm imagining one of the reasons you had 18 at some point is because you wanted some level of physical proximity to your customers. And so I'm wondering if advances in transport that we've had since 2008 has also been a factor that's let you shut down some of those.
In fact, that is the case. When we got down to even 18, when we started consolidating beyond that, before that, we had originally back in 92, we had over 150 data centers, and when we got down to 18 back in 1992, that was a function of not only what was on the network, what was currently riding the existing network that we had, and as we got smaller and smaller and moved everything closer toward our backbone, that allowed us to put more efficiencies on the big data centers that we retained.
Since 2008, has the nature of the work that DECs perform changed very much? Can you talk about how the role of DECs has evolved?
So since 2008, I think there's two things that have changed a lot in the DECs that we've inherited. One is the adoption of enterprise services. Since we started looking, DISA has been starting to focus on how do we take advantage and build out enterprise services that the whole Department of Defense can take advantage of. That was one of those big shifts in capability that we adopted and start to take over. For example, when we started moving forward with enterprise email as an enterprise service for the whole department, that was a game. That was a shift in some of the culture that we were doing for the department for the DEX. Originally, it was mostly focused on mission partner applications, but then we now started to go beyond just the mission partner piece. I think the other area that we shifted on since 2008 would be the adoption and support to our coalition partners with some of the information sharing networks that we have put in place and started to manage those. And thirdly, I think we've done some, with support of some of the combatant commanders in some of those areas. Those three areas have been the biggest shift since 2008 that the DEX have adopted.
And Dave, I think you wanted to chime in on that too, just in terms of how the role of DEX has changed.
I would add to that, that back to your earlier point about bandwidth expansion, one of the key advantages I think we have now that we didn't have then was the significant bandwidth increase that we got through upgrading our communications infrastructure, so that proximity of the capability to the customer was basically taken out of the picture. The ability to host the capability where it made sense from a hosting perspective, not necessarily where the point of need was, allowed us to consolidate and do some things that allowed us to optimize, as opposed to having to put a platform at the customer's front door, if you will. And so by leveraging that increased bandwidth and increased processing capability that technology was giving us, we're able to do things in a smarter fashion to reduce the footprint, as well as to provide new capabilities to a variety of different locations, not just to sort of a regional view of that capability.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Rivera mentioned enterprise email, other enterprise services that you've taken on under this new enterprise construct. Fair to say that since 2008, even as you've reduced the overall number of centers, the actual workload that they perform that they're performing has increased?
Yes. So just a case in point, I mean, email, as one example, we support basically 1.5 million users right now. In the past, we had not had anything near that. Defense collaboration, Defense Connect Online, our collaboration capability, we're now in excess of 1 million users on that, whereas 2 years, 3 years ago, we were probably only at about 200,000. So the enterprise services have continued to increase over time at a fairly significant rate, and we're able to leverage the DEC infrastructure as a means to support that increased usage and demand without having to increase the number of facilities to support the population.
That's Dave Bennett, the Chief Information Officer at the Defense Information Systems Agency. We'll come back and talk more about DISA's strategy for its Defense Enterprise Computing Centers, the Joint Information Environment, and its latest DEC closure at Huntsville, Alabama, after a quick break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Our guests in the first half of the show this week are David Bennett and Alfred Rivera, both from the Defense Information Systems Agency. Before the break, Dave Bennett talked with us about the workload DISA's data centers are performing now compared to 6 years ago when it started to consolidate those big facilities. There are 10 now compared to 18 in 2008. The data center in Huntsville, Alabama was the latest one to shut down at the end of May. As far as the factors that lead to a decision to close a DEC, Mr. Rivera got at this a little bit when he talked about the expense to upgrade them to modern standards. But what are the other things that make a Defense Enterprise Computing Center a good candidate for possible closure or consolidation?
Well, so we're always looking to see what's the right set of capabilities that we need. So we're always looking at it from a financial perspective in terms of what's the cost to maintain the facility at the required level. Many of the facilities are facilities that have been in place for several years. So there's just an inherent cost of keeping it current, as well as what's the cost to take it to the next level in terms of survivability and reliability. And so there's a financial factor that we take into consideration. There's another factor that we're always looking at, and that is how do we optimize performance in terms of manpower to manage the systems, as well as when we start looking at doing remote management of capabilities, are there ways in which we can consolidate different customers or different technical solutions in such a way that we can centralize the function at one facility and remotely manage and execute the mission across a wider number of platforms and locations. So as we do more and more remote management of capabilities, the need to have specifically dedicated facilities in place start to become a variable that you can take a look at and see, does it make sense to retain a particular facility, given the fact that you're able to do remote management, you're able to leverage virtualization and consolidation into other locations. It just creates a shifting dynamic that says, what's the right mix of capabilities and facilities to meet the customer workload? Looking over the horizon, where do we see technology taking us, and how can we continue to condense, if you will, capabilities on platforms, as well as storage, as well as communications? Will that give us the opportunity to reduce footprint, reduce costs, et cetera? So we're always looking at all these things to figure out, is there a smarter, better, cheaper way to be able to do business?
And so as you examine all of those factors, do you have some shorter or longer term goals in terms of how many more decks you want to eliminate from the footprint? Is that sketched out yet?
No, it's an ongoing effort that we have underway. Every time we are doing our budget planning, we're constantly looking at, is it still cost effective? Is it a stretch goal, if you will, that says we need to reduce costs by X amount because of budget drawdown, et cetera. And we look at that and look to see where there's opportunities to save resources. And a deck facility is just a resource that is considered as we go forward in sync with all of the other pieces that are looked at. So it's not a separate category in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. So the DoD CIO's office has this concept called core data centers under this whole joint information environment framework. Talk a bit about how your consolidation plans flow into and align with that CDC concept. And are the remaining decks all going to be CDCs?
So the short answer to your last question there is, yes, we anticipate that all of the decks will be identified as core data centers. The eight decks in CONUS have already been identified as core data centers. But the whole idea behind the core data centers is really the idea of moving to a virtualized platform and getting away from physical devices tied to a single customer and maximizing the use of virtualization to condense the platform footprint and consolidate customer applications into these core data centers. And we'll do that via the virtualization. That whole concept there is the key point to help us figure out how much capacity we can put into each of the data centers, and then from that perspective be able to support the department's mission overall. So we're looking to consolidate the service component applications that need to move into the core data centers by the end of 2018. And additionally, we're also looking at the capabilities that are in the data centers today but hosted on dedicated devices. We're also looking to work with those application owners to virtualize those and move those capabilities into a virtualized infrastructure within the data centers.
And is the base? Go ahead. Go ahead, Mr. Rivera.
Let me just add one more thing. One of the other things that the criteria that we look at for the core data centers, which allowed the DEX to be the initial candidates, was in fact the piece I mentioned earlier, the investment and the scalability and the reliability and resiliency of the current data centers that we have in place allow them to have the resiliency and availability that we're going to need if we're going to start moving these core enterprise applications and enterprise services into a common framework. And so those were some of the criteria, one being, you know, do we have that resiliency in there? Do we have the bandwidth that is available to be scaled up? All those things that determine the criteria, and that's why the DEX were the initial first candidates.
I know you guys are not the policymakers, but is the current thinking still that if there's any application that is used by multiple services, multiple installations, whatever, it needs to go in a CDC? What's kind of the criteria right now for what belongs in a CDC?
So there's an entire process to determine what's going into the core data centers. Each of the service components, the application owners, are supposed to be moving through an application rationalization process to reduce the number of applications down to the critical set of systems that are needed to perform their mission. After you get through that application rationalization process, the next step is to take a look at the capabilities that really have a mission that spans more than one installation. And if you have a capability that is leveraged at more than one location, then those are the capabilities that are targeted to move to the core data center. So it's not just an enterprise service per se that goes to a core data center. It's really a capability that is used more widely than at a single installation as the primary focus of what needs to move into the core data centers.
That's David Bennett, the Chief Information Officer at the Defense Information Systems Agency. The other voice you heard in our discussion of DISA's data centers was Alfred Rivera. He's DISA's Vice Director for Strategic Planning at the moment, but until recently he was in charge of the agency's enterprise services and its data centers. We'll pause for another break, and when we come back, we'll shift gears and get an update on the push from Capitol Hill for acquisition reform, specifically IT acquisition reform. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servian.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive.
The nation, of course, is dealing with a surge in illegal immigration.
Gil Kerlikowski is the commissioner of the Customs and Border Protection.
Other components in the Department of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, and also the Department of Justice have been great assets in helping us get these kids to a place that's safer and, frankly, more hospitable than a Border Patrol station.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
We're back on DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servio. The topic of acquisition reform is back in vogue on Capitol Hill once again. These things work in cycles. It's been a few years since Congress took a serious stab at the issue. This time around, though, leaders, particularly on the House and Senate Armed Services Committees, are spending a lot of time asking for outside input from experts who follow the issue of defense acquisition closely, think tanks, academics, industry associations. Those outside recommendations are now starting to flow in as Congress gets ready to assemble legislation. They're hoping for a vote next year. One of the groups lawmakers turn to for advice is the IT Acquisition Advisory Council. As their name would suggest, they limited their input to the topic of IT acquisition, a major challenge for the Pentagon in and of itself. John Weiler is ITAC's vice chairman. I sat down with him to talk about their recommendations.
As I gather, John, this is essentially an update to what ITAC compiled in 2009.
That's right.
What can you tell me about what has changed in your recommendations since then? What areas have gained more emphasis since then? How does this work product look different from what you sent up a few years back?
Well, mostly it's an update. What has transpired since 2009 till now is another 34 workshops and the ability to take all the other studies that followed us and ingest that data into this new update. Much of that work reaffirms some of our recommendations, but we've also been asked to be a little bit more precise about very specifically what actions should be taken to remediate some of these challenges.
Mm-hmm. At least at a high level, I've got to assume that your diagnosis of the problems in IT acquisition hasn't changed much. Let's talk about what some of those are.
Yeah, there are several root causes. The ones that seem to show up more frequently is leadership. Leadership's always a very important factor. If someone doesn't want to fix something at the top, it won't get fixed. Incentives, those are important issues for everyone. If you're incentivized just to push paper and comply with a bunch of arcane rules, you'll never get the job done. And we see a lot of the problems around the incentives are focused on compliance that hides and obscures accountability versus incentivizing someone to drive an outcome. And we're beginning to see that same understanding in other studies, including Defense Science Board, Defense Business Board, recent updates.
So let's drill down on that leadership issue right now. There doesn't seem to be in the Pentagon anyone who is as much of a champion for successful completion of IT acquisition programs as there is for military hardware programs. Should there be that person?
Well, that's what most of the studies say, is that no one's accountable, no one's in charge. You have a divided responsibility today between the DoD CIO, ATNL, and the CMO, and it's very hard to understand as a program manager, who do you cater to, who do you account to. And what we see as an outcome of that is increased volume of paperwork and analysis and reporting that's not additive to the value of the outcome. So let's take the most simple case. You're competing an outsourcing contract, NMCI. It took them 6 years to recompete at a cost of almost $1 billion in acquisition support services. $1 billion spent to recompete and outsource commodities contracts. It seems rather insane, but it is the truth. And the Air Force ECSS program struggled with which to comply with, Clarence-Cohen Act, the DoD 5000, or the new BC, the old BCL. They complied with all three of them. So, yes, they were compliant. In fact, all the programs that seem to fail are fully compliant, but they still don't achieve the outcome.
And so when you hear folks like Frank Kendall complain about the current state of the acquisition system, I've heard him say essentially that's what we have to do. We have to comply with Clarence-Cohen. We have to comply with procedures for a major automated information system. That's why we need a more simple acquisition system that gives us the flexibility to do what we need to do case by case. Do we need a rewrite of laws here, or is this more, from your perspective, a management problem?
I believe it's a management problem. I believe Frank Kendall could relieve a lot of the pain that the program managers face every day by just managing his own staff, which are the ones that and create this onerous oversight process. And if he held his own people accountable, if they are performing oversight, that they are then also responsible for the outcome, you would see a lot of things change. But it seems that everyone must kneel in front of ATNL and ask, say, Mother, may I, when a lot of those activities don't add value. It doesn't mitigate risk, as evidenced, again, by the humongous failure rate, and all those programs met the criteria over the overseers. So I do agree, as the ATNL staff suggests, that the system and the process is flexible, but steel is also flexible. And it's about that same flexibility. It would take a very, very long time with tremendous amounts of pressure to flex the system. It took over 18 months for the Navy Program Office, SPAWAR, to get some adjustment to the process. And in the end, the feedback that I got from the program executives was it was easier just to comply with all the processes than to ask for changes from those same process owners. Mm-hmm. They're not willing to change. It does not benefit them either way, and they'd rather have someone continue to maintain their role and responsibility in the system. So they don't want to remove themselves out of the system, and that's the problem with changing the process, is you remove people who have their jobs are protected. And that's both government and the CETA contractors and FFRDCs that serve this system. We estimate about 30% of all IT budgets are consumed by just compliance with these arcane processes. Those that have gone through a more simplified approach, still complying with all the rules, have been successful. So there are successes. There are case studies where the system, based on strong leadership within an agency, have been able to bypass unnecessary bureaucratic and Byzantine processes. But it takes them to assert their authority and say, wait a second, we don't need to do that. The law allows us to bypass this process. Usually that means reducing the program's complexity into incremental buys by which you don't meet the threshold of a large ACAT-1 program. ACAT-1 meaning, you know, a very large spend over $20 million.
Right. So if we accept the proposition that this is mainly a management problem and not a defect in the system, the whole reason we're here talking today is because Congress has taken an interest in this issue, and it seems to me that Congress is pretty good at changing systems and legislating. I'm not sure what they do to change management, to impose better management on an organization.
Actually, that's a million-dollar question, because the answer often on the Hill is new legislation. But if you have all the legislation necessary to fix this and it's not being effectively applied, the rules aren't being taken advantage of, then it is a management issue. So how do you turn Congress into a board of directors that operates like a commercial board of directors, mm-hmm. that, you know, takes advantages of their authorities and holds people accountable? Of the disastrous failures, for instance, the Air Force CCSS, one would ask, well, who was held accountable? Who was fired? Nobody. Nobody was fired. You have the DCGS cloud program that Duncan Hunter wrote about, you know, several weeks ago. That's hurt, you know, some good people up in high levels. But who's held accountable for that? $500 million to build a cloud. The other part of the problem that we're seeing in the advent of cloud and large data and COTS is that DoD continues to apply a waterfall approach to IT that's not advocated by Clear Cohen, but is driven by a weapon systems acquisition model. So if we were just to take the Clear Cohen Act guidance and take processes that were already implemented at agencies that follow that process and conform to the law versus the DoD 5000, just saying do Clear Cohen only, we would have the amount of successes invert from the amount of failures. So instead of having 84% failure rates, you'd have 84% success rates. And we have documented those successes. The Air Force achieved that kind of success with something called ASAP. Even the Business Transformation Agency achieved success.
So again, if DoD's got the tools, what can Congress do to compel, encourage individual programs to take advantage of those tools in the way that you think that they should?
If I were Congress, I would commission GAO to go find those agile processes and Clear Cohen Act frameworks that are already in play and saying you will use those for this class of IT programs, period, the end. And tell us, instead of commissioning DoD to come up with a study and a report saying how to do it, which happened under 804, 804 was the groundbreaking legislation to saying stop using a weapon systems acquisition process and go find an agile one. Well, they studied and studied and studied, and they concluded that the process they already have is fine, which is insane. They basically failed to conform to the rule of law.
That's John Weiler, the vice chair of the IT Acquisition Advisory Council. We're talking about that group's recommendations to Congress for reforms to defense acquisition and defense IT acquisition specifically. One more break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of their specific five recommendations. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servian. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, it's On DoD. I'm Jared Servian. One more segment this week as we continue our conversation with John Weiler. He's the vice chairman of the IT Acquisition Advisory Council. They're one of the groups that leaders in Congress asked for advice about potential reforms to defense acquisition as they get ready for a new round of reform legislation next year. In that two-page paper that you guys issued last week, you go through a series of five recommendations. So let's talk through those individually. I'm going to start from the bottom up, actually, since we've already talked about number one, the IT acquisition workforce, and I think that's probably key. You were talking about strong management with an individual program, and people keep coming back to that. If you've got a strong program manager, you can find ways to use existing processes. How are we just lacking in numbers of good people like that throughout the DoD system?
Evidence suggests it's not a number problem. You could make the entire acquisition workforce 30% more effective, so says an earlier study out of Meritalk. They did a humongous interview process, and they found that the workforce believes that they could be 30% more efficient if they actually understood how to use the process effectively. So you have lots of young professionals, and the teachings today at DAU don't teach you anything about the practical needs for IT. It's about conforming to the policy. And you wonder why everyone just focuses on conforming to the policy. So if you gave the acquisition workforce and identified those that do IT versus weapons systems, because it's a completely different skill set. It's a different mentality. It's different. Hammers are great only when you have a nail. So today, we don't provide the curriculum or the acquisition tools, the methods and the training programs to make these acquisition folks effective. And then the incentives go with that, incentivize them to take shortcuts that are allowed by the law and to focus on an outcome for the program versus CYA, I'm going to make sure I follow all the processes available to me in case and when the program fails, which is a highly likely scenario today, I'm covered because I complied with the law.
So let me circle back on something you just said, pointing out that IT is very different from a weapon system. One of the points I've been hearing a lot lately is, well, IT is actually in everything. So maybe the F-35 is an IT program. I don't think anybody has quite gone that far.
But yes, they have actually. I've heard that.
But it goes back to the point that Frank Kendall makes that I raised a little bit ago. So you've got major IT components in a lot of hardware. So there is some blending between the two, right?
So there are two ITs, and there's writing code for a toaster or a F-35. Writing code and buying IT are two different animals. So what needs to be bifurcated is the developmental efforts that are necessary, like an F-35. That is, in fact, DoD unique. Mm-hmm. And the processes that we have today could be improved for DoD software development, but I think they're already heading in the right direction. What's not in place is how do I go out and buy a capability like cloud that already exists and not go down this waterfall software development process that we followed with healthcare.gov, with DCGS Cloud, with Air Force ECSS, with GeoScout. All those fail to acknowledge that there's a commercial item already available, required by law, that I must give favorable deference to under the Clarence Cohen Act, as well as the Economy Act. So we're violating the law any time that we ignore that there's a commercial solution that can deliver 85% of the solution and go out there and commission a contractor to go build it at 100 times the expense of just buying it. And what's compounding the problem, in 2003, there was an effort commissioned by MITRE Corporation, a federally funded research and development corporation. They created this free software initiative called Open Source Free Software. And that turned a corner in a bad way. Government believed that they can get free software, and you can get some software free. And I understand that that has value for some. But to focus all efforts on getting free software in light of the fact that commercial software has greater value has been a change in course that I believe has contributed to most of the failures that I'm seeing in the last 8 years. Software should not be free. If it's free, it's worth what it is. It's a building block, not a replacement for what commercial industry was driving a $3.8 trillion market. You don't see Citigroup, Bank of America, FedEx going out there saying, I'm going to ignore all that and just get the free stuff and then spend billions of dollars building what the market already has.
Well, the open source advocates make the distinction between free as in beer and free as in speech. So is MITRE talking about free speech open? Because I could see some value in that for DoD. If you can take something that is open source, perhaps easier to modify for
like
your own purposes.
Red Hat is one of the biggest providers. Actually, Oracle is one of the biggest providers of open source software. It's a different licensing agreement. It's not the fact that it's free, it's just a different maintenance and upgrade agreement. So you're still paying for support. You're paying it in a different way. So Dave Wintergreen, who did a great job of, with his staff, Dan Reisacker and others, writing the open source memo for DoD, said open source should be considered equal to COTS because they just have different license agreement. What we've seen with this free open source software, FOSS initiative that MITRE created, was ignoring that there is commercially supported software that can get patched, that can prevent security holes. There's a lot of value out of having commercially supportable code versus code that you don't know its DNA. And you don't, it's just so raw and so low. I can get free lumber off the side of the road, but am I going to really do that to build my house? You know, so there does make sense, especially for pilots and for real R&D, to use open source because it represents some interesting areas of investment and understanding of about advances in technology. But by no means should it be considered a replacement for what the commercial market has already developed.
Yeah, I've sidetracked us, so let me try and hit a couple of your other recommendations while we still have some time. Remove innovation barriers. You talk about reestablishing the technology clearinghouse. Remind folks what that is and what it did.
Yeah, in 1999, a study by a FACA study. FACA means I don't remember the acronym, but it means that it's free of conflicts of interest and congressionally acceptable. So this FACA group brought together 11 nonprofits under John Hamry, Stan Soloway, and the leadership in the Pentagon to understand why government was unable to embrace Cleaner Cohen Act and adopt best practices. So the recommendations of that ECCWG study group was to create a technology clearinghouse, and the interoperability clearinghouse was created to do that. It struggled to gain traction because government was more happy with its contractors to reinvent the wheel versus leveraging design patterns and work that had already been done. There's an incentive structure again. So if you, when you outsource your thinking to a contractor, he has little incentive, again, to reuse what has been designed, developed, and created. So in 2007, Congress once again directed DOD to implement a technology clearinghouse, thinking that they would reuse one already created, but instead turned it over to DTEC, and they created from scratch something that later got investigated by Congress under the False Claims Act because it failed to – it was charging for that work but unable to deliver – the kind of capabilities that you couldn't do with a government agency. The government agency doesn't have a way of partnering with industry and doesn't have the mechanisms by which it can assess technology outside of a contract. So the FAR makes it impossible for government to do some things that a public-private partnership is uniquely structured to be able to do.
And just to finish up, one of the proposals in this year's, the Senate version of the National Defense Authorization Act would combine the DoD Chief Information Officer with the DoD Chief Management Officer, I think make that position actually an undersecretary in DoD.
That is correct.
That's something that you fully endorse here. Tell us why you think that would make a difference.
It addresses the management problem. The CIO does not really have authorities in the current environment today. You have Title 10 trumping Title 40, Title 40 being the Cleaner Cohen Act. So by elevating the CIO in a combined combined structure with the chief management officer is really you make IT driven by a management agenda, which is how corporate America does. So this will create the single authority that is necessary. And my suggestion is not all IT would fit in that. It would be, you know, IT infrastructure like JIE, cloud, commodities, things that have broad purpose across the DoD landscape, not embedded systems. So Mr. Kendall and Mr. others are right that not all IT fits in the CIO. There's things that are so uniquely, you know, embedded in satellites and weapon systems that it really needs to stay within the program that hardware is being acquired as well.
Mm-hmm. Last thing, you know, Congress has an appetite to do, you know, broader acquisition reform in both houses, I think, this year. In your discussions in this early phase of the game, do you have any kind of good sense of their level of interest in IT specifically as part of that? I know questions come up in hearings from certain members from time to time, but how much traction does this have on the Hill as far as you can tell?
my sense in talking with Chairman Rogers, who is the Intelligence Committee, and Mac Thornberry and Chairman Issa, I believe this is the greatest interest ever in my 40 years involved that I've seen Congress have an appetite for actually fixing IT. So Clarence Cohen Act was the last great interest in fixing this problem.
18 years ago now, I think?
18 years ago, 1996. Yeah. So this is the time to fix it once and for all, because every national security program will fail if this is not addressed. And our enemies have access to the same technologies we can't buy for 81 months.
John, good talking to you. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
That's John Weiler, the Vice Chairman of the IT Acquisition Advisory Council. And again, ITAC is one of several groups the leaders of the House and the Senate Armed Services Committees asked to submit recommendations for a new round of defense acquisition reform. We'll post a link to their full written response at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. Earlier in the hour, we talked to Alfred Rivera and David Bennett from the Defense Information Systems Agency about their path to data center consolidation and the latest closure of a Defense Enterprise Computing Center. That one was in Huntsville, Alabama. If you missed that conversation, we'll post the full program, as always, at federalnewsradio.com. That's it for this week's show, though. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.